Oh, good evening. Enjoying the summertime flowers. They're really pretty. Already. So here we are in the middle of the Lankas, the Lankavatara Sutra, with Mahamati's many, many, many questions. He doesn't let the Buddha off the hook for a minute. He just keeps asking and asking and asking. And sometimes he says the right thing and the Buddha says, oh, that's great. And sometimes the Buddha says, no, Mahamati, you don't get it. You know, it's not like that at all. There's always a dialogue going on almost in every sutra. From the original stories of Buddha, there's always a conversation. And then all through the centuries, when they put together some sort of material, they bring up our own questions and allow us to, in the terms of this one, project and find ourselves in the material as questions are being asked. Some of them are pretty esoteric and we might never have thought of those questions, and that's kind of interesting too. Why haven't we thought of them? Or this is something I need to think about more. So we're in a place where Buddha is talking about, or Mahamati is questioning Buddha about dependent origination. And dependent origination really is about how everything is connected to everything else. Even though it feels like we're all separated, everything is separated and we can name each thing and experience things as their own being. The flowers, each flower is different from the other. Each petal is different from the other. Each individual piece of the petal is different from each other. You can cut down all the way through any piece of our stuff, and it can be broken down and broken down, and it's all of one thing. It's like talking about the finger without talking about the hand and the arm and the rest of the body. There's nothing that's separate in the way that we like to think of it. And that's dependent origination. We all depend on each other. Everything depends on everything else. And it's based on what is called causes and conditions, that everything is arising based on the things that arose before. So it's so complex that we can't even trace back all the way to know all the causes and conditions that created this moment. And we know that what we did today led to our getting in the car and driving over to Santa Clara and walking into this building, but you can trace your coming here all the way back to your birth, all the way back to your parents' birth, and all the way back to Adam and Eve, or Lucy's kin. There's no disconnect anywhere, and all of them are based on the causes and conditions that brought us to this place and that are leading to the next place. Next moment, next tiny moment. So Mahamati wants to know about causes and conditions, and without a self, how can you have causes and conditions and not have a self? And he says that other people, other religions, talk about causes and conditions being based on some kind of greater power. some kind of higher power, that it comes from above, and it creates each situation, and then we are sort of at the behest of that, whatever we call it, a great spirit, a great God, a great something. He asks, is Buddha's position the same? And Buddha says, no. No, he says, I don't teach that there are no causes, and I don't confuse causes and conditions, but because this exists, that exists. Because of this, there's that. Because of the seed, the flower blooms. It's obvious to us how things, many things are obvious, how they're connected. And many things, we have no clue how it all came together. We'll never know. It's too complicated. As long as people cling to what grasps or what is grasped and are unaware that these things are nothing but perceptions of their own mind, they mistake the existence or non-existence of external objects. But not my teaching of dependent origination. He said, I've always taught that things arise due to the conjunction of causes and conditions, not that they arise without a cause. So it's not that there's no cause, and it's not that there's some invisible cause that of some great power that's over us, but that it's all coming up this way, continually. So I said to myself, it means that the source isn't the source. That if we think of some greater source as the source, that isn't it. It's much more simple than that, in a way, and it's coming from a different direction, you could say. And that leads, of course, to the whole idea of projection and no self, that the self that we think of is a self that's constantly being affected by the causes and conditions that brought it into being in the first place. So it's not that there's nothing here, there's plenty here, but it's not a fixed thing. It isn't fixed for a moment, it's constantly changing and morphing into something else. And so if we project from ourself, our self-image, we're already projecting a dream or a fantasy. Because we don't know what we've become, all we know is what we were a minute ago. But if we hold on to that, that's the grasping that he's talking about. We grasp onto a kind of self that we want to hold. And then we're not in touch with the way things actually are. We lose the sense of presence and the moment. So the best way is, as Dogen said, to forget the self, not because the self is a bad thing, but because it gets in the way. The notion of the self gets in the way. It's a projection that we don't necessarily need. Sometimes it's handy. Sometimes we have to be somebody and be it strong. But we have to know that it's all tenuous and provisional, and it's being made up on the spot by all the causes and conditions that bring us to this place. So it's hard to walk around and think, I'm all these causes and conditions, and how can I? But there's nothing to hold on to. And that's what Pema Chodron often talks about, that we always want some kind of solid ground under our feet, but there really isn't any solid ground. And once we recognize that and accept it, things go easier. It's not such a struggle. But that self-image, we do hold on to. We like it. At least the part that we like. And then there's the part we try to get rid of and we don't like and we pretend isn't there. So Koban always talked about practice as most honesty. Really be honest with yourself about the whole thing, all the causes and conditions, and recognize that this self is this continually changing, but at the same time, life force, you could say, that keeps living itself and being lived. So he goes on. He says, where causes and conditions meet, fools give rise to projections. Unable to fathom what's real, they wander through the inn of three realms. So the foolish try to get rid of the self. And Buddha says, there's no things. And so really no mind behind those things either. It's just life as it lives itself. So then we get back to words again. It comes back to words all the time, to speech, words, words, speech, because that's the mystery of human life. That's the strangest part of it, that we cast our experience into some kind of noise that we make with our body and identify each thing, not just as a thing, but as a thing with words. And Mahamati keeps asking, well, are the words the real? Is that flower a flower? Or could it be something else? And Buddha says, well, you know, it's just a mirage to think that it's a flower. It's just what we call it. That worldly people get confused by the reflections that speech gives us. It gives us back a word that we take then for reality rather than the reality of the flower itself. It's like reading in the paper and saying, I saw it in the paper, it must be true. I see that, I know the name of that flower, so it must be that. Although it could be anything else. It's got a Latin name, which we don't know, probably, usually. It has different name in Bulgaria, I'm sure. So we get deluded just by using words. He said, the wise do not give rise to the thought of being confused or the thought of not being confused by a delusion. So it's not that our delusions are to be avoided or wiped out. It's like what Koban says about the Bodhisattva vows. Delusions are inexhaustible. They will end by themselves. If we put ourselves in some kind of debate with it, whether it is or it isn't, then we're totally confusing ourselves. It's better to stay in the middle of things rather than lurch to one side or the other. Because there are both sides in every occasion. Different characteristics of delusions are projections, and they're destroyed. Thus, delusions are eternal. Um, the realms of the foolish beings are different from not taking a side. For example, pretas see and do not see the Ganges. It does not exist as a delusion. So pretas are hungry ghosts, and they see water as fire. Fish see water as what we would think of as air. Fish breathe in the water in a way that we would never do, could never do. So the wise are neither confused nor not confused by delusions, because their characteristics are not destroyed. Delusions are eternal. It's the characteristics of projections that are destroyed. If anyone gives rise to the slightest perception of a delusion, it does not qualify as Buddha knowledge. It's the talk of fools and not of the wise. And then he outlines the different paths. The Shravaka path is about attachment to individual characteristics. The Pratyeka Buddha path is the result of attachment to aversion. The Buddha path is the eternal existence as non-existent and of the non-projection of characteristics. Not holding on to anything, basically. The others are in some way attached. When delusions are not projected, Mahamati, the wise are able to transform the existence of the habit energy of the mind, the will, and consciousness into what is called suchness. The just being, just as it is, suchness. And to make it clearer, Buddha says, I say to be free of projection means to be free of all projections. So Mahamati says, do delusions exist or not? And Buddha says, they're like illusions. There's nothing to grasp. If a delusion had something that could be grasped, the existence of grasping would never cease, and dependent origination would amount to creation by causes and conditions, as claimed by followers of other paths. So Mahamati says, if a delusion is like an illusion, can it serve as the cause of other delusions? And Buddha says, an illusion is not the cause of a delusion because it does not give rise to misperception. An illusion does not give rise to misperception because it does not involve projection. Illusions are produced by magic and not by the habit energy of projections or misperceptions. It is the minds of fools that become attached to delusions, not those of the wise. So, even though we depend on words, if we see our delusions as anything real, then the delusions would be real. But it's like, he said, if something should appear after delusions are abandoned, it would be another delusion, like a cataract. With a cataract, you see lights around a light. It's not a real light around a light. It's from your own eye. So it's a projection from your own misperception. So again, we're always looking for clarity, always looking for what's real and how we're misperceiving and deluding ourselves often for the sake of our story. So he says, Mahamati, in viewing everything as an illusion, if not for illusions, there would be nothing to compare things to. So, if it's only dreams, that could be the only thing that we could talk about. If everything that exists was illusory because of attachment to different illusory characteristics, something would exist that wasn't illusory. But the appearance of the different uncaused characteristics of a form is illusory. It isn't attachment to different illusory characteristics that make things seem illusory. He says it isn't because of attachment, Duda says, to different illusory characteristics that makes everything seem illusory. Rather, it's because everything is unreal and vanishes like lightning. This is why it's illusory. It appears for a moment like lightning, and as soon as it appears, it disappears. This is not how things appear to foolish people who observe everything in terms of the individual and shared characteristics of their own projections. Since what doesn't exist doesn't appear, they remain attached to the characteristics of form. Transient as lightning, unreal, thus they're called illusory. So our minds want to fix things, and Buddha keeps saying, if you try to fix it, you're missing what the next thing is. So I think we have grown up to feel that we have to find our fixed place in order to feel safe, and to loosen that fixity and allow what happens next to be a surprise is the kind of practice that Buddha is encouraging us to understand, to realize that what we think is fixed isn't fixed. What we think is real is already gone, and something else has taken its place. And then Mahamati says, well, there's a contradiction here. He doesn't say that. He says, what is non-arising is illusory. Is there not a contradiction in the Bhagavan's earlier and later statement? He's very skillful in asking his question. Wouldn't just be so rude as I just said. And Buddha told Mahamati, it's not true that when I say what is non-arising is illusory, there is a contradiction. And why not? Because what arises does not arise. When you realize that whether something exists or not is nothing but the perception of your own mind, its external existence is seen as non-existent and non-arising. Mahamati, there is no contradiction in my earlier and later statements. However, it's to refute the arising from causes of other schools that I say everything is non-arising. Confused members of other schools maintain the arising of existence or non-existence and deny that they are the result of attachment to their own projections. Mahamati, because I deny the arising of existence or non-existence, I teach the teaching of non-arising. I teach existence to refute the nihilistic view that nothing exists, and so that my disciples will accept samsara, accept this world of suffering, so-called birth and death, this life of birth and death. Because there are some practices that are all devoted to achieving enlightenment and achieving it fast in order to be released from this life and never return. The Shravaka practice. This is at the time that this was written, was a usual practice. The most usual practice was monks who became monks and struggled and sat for long periods in order to cross the stream and be freed forever. And the change came when it began to be realized that the mind of compassion was left out in that kind of practice. That it was actually very self-involved practice. And the interdependence of the teaching was not being lived. And so there was a big change. The Mahayana changed to an outward-looking practice, and an inward-looking that freed one to look outward and begin to live in the world of suffering in order to participate with all beings, to be recognize the suffering of all beings and participate in the freeing up of all beings from their suffering in the world of samsara. So instead of thinking of samsara as something to get rid of or to flee from, it turns and becomes a point of practice. And as they say, if it becomes a point of practice and it's really seen for what it is, it becomes flooded with light. It becomes nirvana itself. And that's what Buddha is pointing to. I teach the illusoriness of self-existence so they'll get free of self-existence. He says, to refute arising from causes and attachment to, from causes and attachment to the self-existence of conditions, and to prevent foolish people from clinging to erroneous views and hopes regarding what belongs to themselves and others, and from creating mistaken doctrines about how to see things as they really are, I teach that the self-existence of everything is an illusion and a dream. Mahamati, to see things as they really are means to transcend what are nothing but perceptions of your own mind. Non-arising means non-existence. Existence includes samsara. Who sees these as illusions doesn't give rise to projections of form. And it goes on to about words and phrases and letter units. So he's not done with the words yet. But I think we are for the moment. Are there questions? Donnelly?
Lots of questions, but one. Were delusion and illusions, was he making this distinction of the projection and ignorance?
Yeah. So that if we see some shimmering water on the road, that's one thing. But to imagine that where somebody is another kind of mystic.
Reading about the deluded people believing in their projections, I was thinking about the Jungian shadow, the concept that we have all have a shadow side that we don't want to look at, so we put it out on other people.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to me that fit with what you were saying about the deluded person.
Yes.
That we all are deluded.
Yes, and projecting it in that way.
And that we put that out on other people and that try to get rid of it.
Yes, yes.
So it's not just about attachment, it's also about getting rid of
it. Exactly, that's the other side of attachment, yeah. Somebody told me about a wonderful party she went to where you were supposed to dress as your shadow.
Oh.
I always thought that would be so interesting. You can think about that on the way home.
Might get hit.
Well, it's 8 o'clock.